Good evening. We should have introductions around tonight. I've got some.
Jeannie. You too. Randy. Sonia. Britt. Annie. Ellie. Andy. Sarah. Bob. And Angie.
Takes a while to remember everything, but it's nice to see everybody. We're working through quietly and peacefully this amazing little poem that was written in, 800 AD or something like that. So very long time ago. And yet, as we nibble at it, bit by bit, it comes to have, in its own way, it's rather like my own teacher, Coben, used to teach in a kind of spiral. He would talk around and then come back around and come back around until some people got very annoyed with it because he wasn't going in a straight line. But the Dharma isn't a straight line, or at least that's just one piece of it. And if we don't have to engage too much of our intellect, we can begin to let the whole thing sink down and inform the rest of us. We're a huge mind, and intellect is just a tiny part of it. So this especially always seems to me, you can't nail it down and you can't make it be something direct, because it's not direct. But it feeds us in some way. So we're at 29. And I thought what I would do is read the next seven, because they're all short and they all relate to each other. Starting with number 29 on page 103, if you're using this book. It's the one that says, understand the relativity of object and subject. The relativity of object and subject, and the basic reality, the unity of emptiness. Our experience is always of me, the subject, and everything else as our object. It's what we encounter. It's not me. Everything we meet is not me, as long as we posit a me. But if you consider it carefully, you'll see that whatever you know about me, your own self, is another object of mind. Anything that we consider an object is just an experience of thought about something. And the only way we can know ourselves is as a thought about something. So in that sense, it's completely interpenetrated, subject and object. On the other side of it is that the whole thing is what we call emptiness. That you can't really say this side without that side, but it's all sides, really. The whole thing is included. And we call that emptiness. Understand the relativity of these two and the basic reality, which is the unity of emptiness. We always say it's all relative. It's all contingent, one thing on another. Causes rise up and conditions create a situation that comes and goes. But the whole thing is held. The whole thing is already. So the important thing, as Musang says about this, is that greed, hatred, and delusion, or ignorance, are what are considered the three extreme difficulties of our life. The things that drive us. If we're not awake. And so the point of practice is to wake up. And to wake up to the greed, hatred, and delusion that are a part of our being as humans, and which gives so much trouble to ourselves and to others. As long as we're unconscious of how we are in the world, then we are on automatic much of the time. And if we're a greed person, then we're saturated with greed and make our decisions based on what we can get. If we're an anger or hatred person, then we base our decisions on what we can manage to get, keep away or get rid of. And if we're an ignorance specialist, we live with blinders on. Can't see, don't want to see. So it's very important, this sitting practice. As I always say, if we don't know ourselves, we really aren't living. It's only when we're able to truly face ourselves that our life becomes electrified, made vivid. In all of its mess, and in all of its beauty. So he goes on to say in the poem, in this emptiness, the two, subject and object, or self and other, are indistinguishable. And each one contains in itself the whole world. You can't tell them apart. You can try, but it's not true. So he goes on to, he was a physicist. This monk, this Korean monk, and he often in his work brought things back in Buddhism to physics. And this is what he says about this, about emptiness. In this emptiness, subject and object are indistinguishable, and each contains in itself the whole world. So here's a little physics lesson. At any given time, light can manifest itself as wave or particle. Does everybody know that? They can measure it as a wave, but they can measure it as a thing. And it's the same light. It just depends on how it's seen. Different states, but actually the same state. However, before the manifestation as wave or particle, each is indistinguishable in their unmanifest aspect, before they become light. This unmanifest aspect or source is pure energy. And pure energy itself cannot be apprehended apart from the manifested wave or particle. We wouldn't know what energy was unless we experience light, because we have some experience, then we call it light. But behind the light is the energy that creates it. You could say the sun. Thus, the manifest is the unmanifest and contains within itself the entire universe of the unmanifest. Since every manifest entity contains the entire unmanifest, it is equal to and indistinguishable from all other manifests and must remain unprivileged, which means that everything is equal. Unprivileged means you can't take one and make it special, because it's all coming from the same place. If all multiplicity, all the many things, are unprivileged, even the one cannot be privileged, because the one is indistinguishable from the multiplicity. So although we're little animals running around and bumping into things and experiencing many things, we ourselves are energy. We ourselves are light. And we ourselves are indistinguishable from each other and from all other manifestation. As our mind works, we pick out things and name them and give them qualities and judge them as better or worse. But that's all just how, in a way, we amuse ourselves. It's our play. If we don't know it's our play and take it too seriously, then we get mired in something of a mess. So to always realize that although it seems like bits and pieces, and we ourselves are bits and pieces, that it's all of a piece. It's all the same soup. So he goes on then, the poem goes on. If you do not discriminate between coarse and fine, you will not be tempted to prejudice and opinion. So this is all about opinions and judgments. If you don't discriminate between what feels good and what feels gritty, that's extra. And we do that for our interest and amusement. It makes life more interesting to be able to say, the pudding is lovely and smooth on my tongue, and the sand is gritty under my feet. It's we enjoy the world in this way. But if we become annoyed with the sand and irritated, and out of our irritation create a whole scene in our mind, that's extra. That's prejudice and opinion. So even the really, really good things, if we get really caught up in the really, really good things and start comparing them to the not so good, the gritty ones, it makes the really good things unpleasant also and problematic. Our mind works in that way. It isn't that it's a good thing or a bad thing, it's just that it creates difficulty for us. I think because we're new at this, new at being thinking mammals. So he goes on to say, he says that letting go of longing and clinging exposes the mind essence behind everything. That's Musong again. Letting go of longing and clinging exposes the mind essence behind everything. The energy, you could say. It's certainly freedom for us. The poem goes on, to live in the great way is neither easy nor difficult, but those with limited views are fearful and irresolute. It's hard to fathom because things do seem hard and they do seem easy. There's some days when everything goes well and we say, oh, aren't I great? I had this easy day, like I did it. And it's a hard day and I think, why are they doing this to me? It's how our mind works. Musong says we create categories in which to suffer and enjoy. I like that very much. We make the category. We decide what's something that's going to be easy and what's going to be difficult. The basic thing is just the basic thing. Sometimes when people are sewing raksu, they say, oh, I can't sew, or this looks terrible. And actually, there's no way to judge such a thing. It just looks the way it looks, which is that person, it's one with the person, whatever we do, the cake we bake, the car we drive even, it's all one with us. So there's no way to judge. Of course, people love to judge. Oh, that's no good. But the truth is that goodness runs through everything. Goodness is something entirely different. It's hard to remember. The faster, the poem says, the faster they hurry, meaning we hurry, the slower they go. And clinging cannot be limited. And even to be attached to the idea of enlightenment is to go astray. So, Musong talks about the desire for enlightenment as the stink of Zen. And he talks from the standpoint of a monastic practice, I think, and how people try to be more enlightened than other people and compare experiences, like, oh, my experience was much deeper than his experience, and blah, 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 and all of which is total nonsense. It's just more of what this is talking about. It's just creating confusion and pain, actually. A lot of pain. So he says, just let things be in their own way, and there will be neither coming nor going. Just letting things be in their own way. If you've been around children, you can see how if you try to cram a child into a certain way, it becomes extremely difficult for the child. As adults, we try to create a safe place where a child can find his own way and get lost a lot of times. But the ideal is to, for the child to unfold as herself, as himself. To let the whole thing be the whole thing. And that's the same for us as grown-ups, too. We're still unfolding. And if we're too rigid, and often in our background are anxious teachers and parents and kin who want us to be a certain way. So it's still a sort of ongoing project to find out, what is my way? How can you be your own way? And then there will be neither coming nor going. So suddenly, it brings us right back to the present moment. If we're always trying to live up to some ideal, if we're always uncomfortable and dissatisfied, we're always on our way somewhere, or we're always trying to get somewhere, or coming back somewhere. But what he's saying is, if you let things just be in their own way, you're right here, right now, you're home. You don't have to go anywhere. And that's Buddha. One of the words for Buddha is Tathagata. In fact, we say that at that little verse at the beginning of the talk, the Tathagata's way. Tathagata means thus come, and the thus means right here, and thus gone means right here. It's how we experience moment by moment by moment, living and dying. And the last one I'll read is number 35. Obey the nature of things, your own nature, and you will walk freely and undisturbed. So, in a way, you can't completely control your own unfolding. And by far the best is to allow ourselves to be surprised. Study ourselves. Be surprised. Unfold. and then forget the self as it all shows how it is, how we all are in here together. So that's that bit. Are there questions and comments?
Dan's comment last week about flipping the numbers on who's the most important in the universe. And I was thinking about it, and actually I figure I'm about 1 billionth of the universe. And you were saying how we're just part of it. Maybe that's actually kind of terrifying. I'm not sure if I really rest in the thought that I'm sort of something. And it is true, but I don't know how are we supposed to dwell on the fact that the universe doesn't, we're just part of it, and there's no partiality really, and we're just happy participating in it. And I guess I brought this up because right at the end, there was a quote about going unmolested, is that the word? You read for a moment something about if you're just in the way, then you walk in the world unmolested.
Freely, yeah, yes,
freely.
Yes.
And as like freely, right into death, right into calamity. I don't know, it seems a bit like a false promise, this idea that if you just rest in the way, things will go okay.
Oh, he doesn't say that, he says you'll be free.
Ah.
It means you're getting in a lot more trouble, I think.
Saying how we're sitting helps us maybe see things more clearly. And I would say that this is sort of a paradox because I always fear long sessions of sitting, like, oh no, what if I see things clearly? It might not go so well. But in fact, it's always, or at least so far for me, it's never been bad. It's always actually somehow everything just seems more okay. So, oh, I don't know, it seems like there's some weird paradox in that?
Yes. It is a paradox.
Is it?
Yeah. Our whole life is a paradox, really. So I've been bringing up the emptiness side, mm-hmm. and you're bringing up the form side. Mm-hmm. And as we say every time we meet, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Mm-hmm. And that's what he's saying here also, emphasizing the emptiness, but of course, here we are, you know, lumps of stuff running around and having a good time. So, but if we're running around in ignorance, then we suffer. And Buddha's concern was about our suffering. And so everyone who is teaching, like this one who came, 1,000 years after Buddha or so, keeps returning back to the same point, that we will continue to suffer as long as we are lost in greed, hatred, and delusion. And the way to get unlost is to let go of holding on so tight to what we think is true, and try to find out what really is happening, and be willing to find out and to face it. So it doesn't, in a way, practice doesn't get easier. You know, I think that's what those fights about enlightenment were in the monastery. Oh, I'm more enlightened than he is, thinking, oh, my life is so much better. But actually, it doesn't turn out that way. It just becomes a bigger responsibility as your life opens up. You begin to feel for others much more, and have a relationship with everyone in a much different way. It's not thou and it, as we were saying about I and thou. People aren't its anymore. They're actual living beings, just like oneself. So it makes a difference. And maybe our life is shortened because of it also, because we would be willing to go farther out on a limb than we might if we were just living in our little castle. Who is this?
Most of them, he says something like it's not ideal, or there's something unpleasant about reality or something.
No, I said that. I didn't think he did. I said terrifying.
I thought you were just trying to say that's what it is. Like Lanzi says somewhere in the morality classic, the Tao of Jesus, earth and heaven and earth are not kind or benevolent, I'm kind of They treat a thousand things as straw dogs. In other words, the universe doesn't care.
Yes.
In a sense.
Yes.
I mean, it's indifferent. It's just kind of I'm admitting.
Well, that's one side.
And I thought he was just trying to say, well, accept it. Not even accept it. Just
see it as it is.
See that way and go on. Because
well,
not any different than that thing or another is all the same.
Except that he is encouraging us to not be clinging to things. So he is advising us to change something, change the way we see things. In a way, Buddhism is all about view, is the first thing, how we are able to see it. Wordsworth said, fear and beauty. That was how he summed up life. Fear and beauty. It is scary. Mostly people don't want to die. Though sometimes people do. But all of those things are a part of it. Huge part of it. Yes?
I'm a little confused about and not knowing much about this yet. What motivates a person in, you know, if I was able to completely stop clinging and avoiding of what would be left, and what would motivate me? Would there be any motivation? Would I just sit there?
Yes, a blob.
That's my fear.
No, actually what happens if people practice for a long period of time is I always say it's like being boiled down and become more and more themselves, more and more that wonderful taste, because there's no disturbance that comes in the way of just being what it is. There's no effort to try to be something else, and there's no holding on and trying to make it be something when it wants to go on, because everything is going on and changing all the time. So freedom, I think, is what he's talking about, just going on with it, letting it go, or in the Taoist sense, be like water, which is always flowing and always finding the lowest point. So it's not glorious, you know, it's not great, it's just very, very fresh and real. Or it's our energetic that we live, just as we are. No, you won't turn into a blob, I promise.
You said something about how children and how it's good to, you know, not to try to make them into something. Parents often try to make them into something that they want. That really helps me. I can relate to that.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I think your fear is kind of a classic, atypical fear in that if I let go of me, what's going to become of me? I'm going to become, and it's that paradox, and somehow like the very thing that's causing me pain is the thing I identify as me somehow. It's like my ego it doesn't understand, there's something it doesn't, and so it fears its own demise, it's like I want to peek over the edge, but you can't peek, there's no peeking to the other side. God, this is not going to sound very good.
That's because the ego doesn't exist.
Exactly.
It thinks it does.
It is me. But it is me, and so from its perspective, trying to understand, it can't. And so it has a fear. Oh, annihilation. Well, I'll become a non-entity. I'm going to be a blob. I'm going to be a... Right? Run! But then there's nowhere to run. You run right back in. To the same thing. So.
Wherever you go, that's where you are.
Wherever you go, there you show up. You can run, but you can't hide. So it is a typical. Everyone has that fear manifested in one form or another.
Yeah.
I know we're running out of time, but it reminded me, I was recently watching old episodes of a TV show, The Dollhouse, and it. Somehow everyone loses who they think they are, and in it the producers made these people who have forgotten who they are and what are their stories become ravening, like flesh-eating cannibals just run through the street. And that's what
I never saw that show, but I see that show.
That sounds like just your cup of tea.
I come into this with all these ideas about what I'm going to, with all of my particular fears of the world and life. And so I want to do this spiritual practice, and I want to get the answer. I want to get to quench these particular fears.
and yet that's not what it's about at all. It's that's still the ego. It's ego's dream of what it has determined it needs, not what we actually need. So
when we sit still for a length of time like this, those fears come up, and we've tied ourselves in a knot so we can't run away, and we've committed to sit 40 minutes or sit half a day or so, so we can't avoid them anymore. And so it's not some big dramatic ta-da thing, it's just that little by little you begin to face those fears and see them for what they are. Yet what we think they are is so different from what they really are. And as we sit, we begin to develop familiarity with how our mind is working and all the bullshit that's going on in it all the time, and all the things that we fear turn out to be often just all made up. So that's why Zazen is so important. You know, we can talk forever about these things, but it's Zazen that gives us the experience of deep knowledge of what this is. That's really what it's for. Thank you all. Good questions. Good discussion.
Powerful teaching.